Our Bible reading today will be from Genesis 9, verses 18 to 29. The sons of Noah who came out of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Ham was the father of Canaan. These were the three sons of Noah, and from them came the people who were scattered over the whole earth. Noah, a man of the soil, proceeded to plant a vineyard. When he drank some of its wine, he became drunk and lay uncovered in his tent. Ham, the father of Canaan, saw his father naked and told his two brothers outside. But Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it across their shoulders. They walked in backward and covered their father's naked body. Their faces were turned the other way so that they would not see their father naked. When Noah awoke from his wine and found out what his youngest son had done, he said, "Cursed be Canaan, the lowest of slaves he will be to his brothers." He also said, "Praise be to the Lord, the God of Shem. May Canaan be the slave of Shem. May God extend Japheth's territory. May Japheth live in the tents of Shem, and may Canaan be the slave of Japheth." After the flood, Noah lived 350 years. Noah lived a total of 950 years, and then he died.
Good morning, everyone. If you're just joining us, we've been working our way through the book of Genesis. We've actually just got this week and next week until we're done in Genesis for this year, and we start in on the book of Revelation. Remember, we're doing the epic beginning and the epic end. And so that's in 2 weeks we'll be starting in Revelation. We've been working our way through. We're up to second half of chapter 9 and all of chapter 10. That's what we're doing today. So Kira read out the second half of chapter 9. We've not read out chapter 10. It's all a genealogy, and be pretty hard work to read it out, to be honest. I'll show you what we're doing once we get to that. Just real quick, after the service, like 5 minutes after the end of the service, there's going to be a Grace Kids teachers and helpers meeting down the back on the couches, like downstairs on the couches down there. And so if that's you, or if you've even thought about one day helping out with that ministry, and honestly, we'd love to see more people helping out with that ministry. It'd be really great if you could join us down there for that. It's going to be a really quick meeting. We're just talking about mostly about how we structure Grace Kids so that we can, if we need to go to two services, we can do that well. Okay. Why don't I pray and we'll start. Lord God, you are really massively sovereign. You are king over all things, and the ruler of the heavens and the earth. And as we look at just this, in lots of ways, sort of just the next story along in the book of Genesis, and more unfolding of the fate of humanity, help us to not just see what's going on in the story and the characters written down, but also help us to see your hand at work, your power displayed in events that happen, and that's true right across history and across the world, and that you are king regardless. And I pray that you'd help us see all these things this morning. Amen. So one of the things that's come up lots in the last few weeks, as we've been working through the last few sort of chapters 6, 7, and 8 in Genesis, we've seen that Noah is the new Adam. Like Noah's emergence from the ark is paralleled with Adam's emergence into life. He's the governor of creation, the father of humanity, the bearer of the image of God. And as Noah steps onto dry ground, he does so as the one through whom God would establish humans on earth, relating to other creatures on earth, just like Adam. And so he's the new Adam. What we see this week, though, is that Noah is the sort of not-so-new Adam. It's not that shiny, not that polished and clean. The flood did not change the human heart, and it did not fix the inherent taint, the tarnish, the blemish of human sin. See, in lots of ways, when you read the stories of Genesis, they almost read like hero stories. And in fact, that's often how we read the whole of the Old Testament. Sometimes that's how we teach it to our children, and that's what we think the point of the Old Testament is. Abraham's faith, David's strength, Daniel's fearlessness. Be like Abraham, be like David, be like Daniel. We think that's the point of the Old Testament. But that's not the point of the Old Testament. You see, the stories in the Old Testament, and particularly for us, the stories in Genesis, they are filled with these dominant characters. And from here on in, after Noah, the main characters are going to be Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, this family line. All of the rest of Genesis, from this point on, is bound up with the family of Abraham. And these stories that the writer tells us about this family of Abraham, they are sort of like hero stories of old. He went on a quest and he faced a challenge and he overcame his adversaries. But actually the stories in Genesis and the apparent heroes in them, there are good things about Noah and Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. But if you're actually paying attention to the way the writer is presenting these guys, you realize, wait, these guys can't be the heroes. And you realize that as you read these stories, perhaps they're not really hero stories, but more like parodies of a hero story. They're almost making fun of the hero stories. They go, well, here's your hero, but guess what? He's morally questionable. He's a terrible father. He's extremely selfish. He's a polygamist. And as you're reading this, and you're meant to go, but wait a second, if Noah's not the hero, and if Abraham and Isaac and Jacob aren't the heroes, who's the hero of this story? Because the main characters, they do overcome their adversaries and they do prosper, but they're not the ones who do the overcoming. They're not the ones who achieve the victory over their enemies. And so who then is the hero of this story? Today, pretty simply, I'm going to work through what happens in chapter 9, and then have a look at the genealogy in chapter 10. And then we'll just come back and I want to make three observations about what we've seen. Now, we've just had in chapter 6, 7, and 8, and sort of the start of 9, we've just had three chapters of the writer telling us about how great Noah is. It's an impressive life, no doubt. But his life will end with Noah cranky and naked and abused and cursing his son, and most importantly, it will end with him dead. Chapter 9, verse 29, and he died. And so you're meant to go, is this guy the hero of this story? And so Noah survives the flood, and yet he still died. Death is still the reality. And his impressive life fizzles out into this final scene of shame. Let me give you a quick retelling of this scene of shame. Noah and his family, they settle on the land. They've stepped off the ark and they're on the land. And Noah's got three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And we're told early on that Ham was the father of Canaan. It's a name to lock away for later. Noah starts life as a farmer. And we're told, he's called, verse 20, a man of the soil. Now, as you read that line, man of the soil, you're immediately meant to think of what's come before in the book of Genesis. Adam is literally a man of the ground. Like the writer tells us, he was made from the earth. And so he was made from the earth, and then as he sins and God curses the earth, curses the soil. So that Noah, he's like Adam in being a man of the soil, and like Adam, he tends a garden, but he's also contending with the fact that that soil is cursed. Noah plants a vineyard, he makes wine, he gets drunk, and he lies, and as a result of his drunkenness, he gets nude, gets naked, and he's in his tent, all exposed. Now remember, nakedness in Genesis, from Genesis 3 on, is never just nakedness. It's from Genesis 3, it's become this representation of the shame that comes from sin. Noah's uncoveredness exposes not just his genitals, it exposes his sin and his shame. And that is absolutely how this is meant to be read. This isn't just an exposing of skin. In the story of Genesis, it's saying that his shame is exposed like Adam's shame was exposed. His sin is seen. And then while he lies there in the nutty, in the tent, Ham, his son, Ham, the father of Canaan, don't forget, he comes in and he sees his father's nakedness. Now, there is very possibly a double entendre here. In fact, the more I read this, the more likely I think that this is the case. It's very possible that that phrase, saw his father's nakedness, is a euphemism for something more sexually sinister. In Leviticus, to see someone's nakedness is sort of like a code or shorthand for sexual relations. And so it's actually very possible that Ham is doing something more sinister than, oh, whoops, Dad, where's your pants? You know, whatever is going on, you're meant to be disgusted by it. Ham, though, is not disgusted by it. Whatever he does, he then goes and tells his brothers about it. His brothers, though, they respond very differently. They cover their father's nakedness and his shame. And it's actually quite detailed about how careful they are to not see their father's nakedness and how careful they are to cover him up. And at this point, you notice all the similarities between Adam and Noah. Both are said to walk with God. Both govern the other creatures of creation. Both father three sons, and both work the soil. But then both sin through the fruit of the tree in the garden that they are meant to be caring for. Both are exposed in their shame and their nakedness. Both need covering up. Adam gets covered up by God. Noah gets covered up by his sons. Both have a particularly wicked son whose descendants will feel the effect of that son's sin. Both have a wicked son who will live under a curse. Cain, the son of Adam, gets cursed in chapter 4. Here, Ham, the son of Noah, gets cursed by his father. When Noah awoke from his wine and found out that what his youngest son had done to him, he said, "Cursed be Canaan, the lowest of slaves will he be to his brothers." He also said, "Praise be to the Lord, the God of Shem. May Canaan be the slave of Shem. May God extend Japheth's territory, and may Japheth live in the tents of Shem, and may Canaan be the slave of Japheth." Now, heaps of the book of Genesis is about the impact that sin has on family. Here, Noah doesn't just curse Ham, he curses Ham's son, Canaan. It's as though Noah is paying Ham back for what Ham has done to him. It's like Noah saying, "I've got a pathetic son. I hope you have a pathetic son too." Now, I don't know if Noah is a prophet here, like prophesying, or if he's just venting his rage at him. But actually, it doesn't really matter. The thing the writer is showing us is that Noah's story is happening just like Adam's story. And that's made absolute at the end of chapter 9. Noah lived a total of 950 years and then he died. Noah is dead, dead like Adam. And so here at the end of chapter 9, if you remember from a few weeks ago, the writer drifts back into the formula, into the genealogy formula that he's used in chapter 5. And so here he's finishing off that genealogy, that connection of Adam down the line, and that there's that repeated refrain, and he died, and he died, and he died. Noah didn't die, he survives the flood, but then you come to the end of chapter 9, and he died. Noah's dead like Adam is dead. And that connection to Adam, it's not just there in the story of chapter 9, it's there in the genealogy then of chapter 10, as the writer talks about what happens with the sons of Noah. And in chapter 10, you're meant to see that things are perhaps worse than you think. Because you might think, all right, so you've got these three sons, the Ham, he's horrible, but the other guys, well, like, they're noble, and surely they'll produce this noble line. Now, the brothers, they are noble in this instance. They do the right thing. They are a great example of honour and integrity that Israel is supposed to see here. However, the genealogy in the next chapter in chapter 10, as it follows the line of all three sons, it's really not that good. The genealogy is sort of indicating where these families end up, and like you get to the end of chapter 10, and there are no noble lines. There's nothing. Like, it's just all humanity, and then in chapter 11, humanity is going to stand in opposition to God. Sons of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, all of them. Now, I've done a bit of a family tree. I've turned chapter 10 into a family tree. You're not meant to be able to read those names. You sort of just need to be able to see sort of the shape of where things go. And what I'm going to do, rather than sort of reading through the genealogy, I'm going to give you an overview of each of the sons' descendants, where they head in chapter 10. Even though the birth order seems to be Shem, Ham, Japheth, the genealogy order goes Japheth, Ham, Shem. And so that's the order we're going to follow. Now, what we're going to see is that this family tree is as much about geography as it is about people's names and the families that flow from them. And you're really meant to read this thinking about how Israel viewed the world around them. So if you think of Israel being at the center of their world, and then so that's sort of your reference point, and then you think about where all these people end up, like that's you're meant to see that. All right. Japheth. We read that Japheth has a bunch of kids, and his kids have a bunch of kids, and his kids, then those kids have a bunch of kids, etc. And we're told in verse 5 that from this line comes a maritime people. And so, the Mediterranean, that's where these people, this line of Japheth spreads. And so they'll settle to the north and the west of Israel. Then there's Ham. And there's more names with Ham that are recorded here, so it's smaller and a bit more crowded. But Ham has four sons, Cush, Egypt, Put, and Canaan. Now, already there, you can see that some of these names represent nations. And if you work through the names of these people, like with Japheth, it's not just names, it's people groups and geography being represented by this genealogy. And the descendants of Ham, they spread all over. But with Ham, there's this emphasis on two groups and two places with relation to Israel. The descendants of Ham represent the enemies from afar and the enemies that are close. There's this emphasis, first of all, as you're reading through, on the descendants of Ham's first three sons, and of Cush, Egypt, and Put, and these people will settle sort of further out. There's a bit of emphasis on a bloke by the name of Nimrod. He's one of Ham's great grandsons, and Nimrod's this mighty man, and he travels around, and he sort of settles over in the Far East, and he builds cities that will become major cities in the Eastern Empires, like empires of Assyria and Babylon. And those nations, they are going to be, their empires are going to wreak havoc on Israel. One of the sons of Ham is literally named Egypt, the people in the southwest who will enslave the Hebrews. So that's where the descendants of Ham in sort of the first three of Ham's sons settle. They're distant enemies. But then there's extra special emphasis in Ham's line and his son Canaan. And it's been flagged already, Ham is the father of Canaan. And Canaan will become the place name and the name of the people group that will possess the land that God will give to Israel. And Canaan's sons, this list of names that is just there, that's going to be a list of names that come up again and again in the Old Testament. When God's talking about the people that they need to wipe out and the people that are causing Israel problem, it's going to be this group of peoples. And it will be Canaan's line that Israel will battle with. And not just physical battle, but like these people are going to be Israel's spiritual battle. They will tempt Israel with foreign gods. They will offend Yahweh with their horrible practices like child sacrifice. Any child sacrifice in the Bible, it, it's reference to this group of people. It's horrible. And you're meant to see it as horrible. These are the people that Israel were meant to wipe out because of their wickedness. But Israel were instead led astray by their wickedness. This is like the rogues gallery of Israel's close enemies. And it's with these people that Israel will fight for their own identity. And so you look at the map and the descendants of Ham, the descendants of Canaan, they're settling in that land of Canaan, the land of Palestine, where Israel are going to settle. They're close enemies. Then we come to the line of Shem. Shem's sons, they're not particularly famous names to our ears, and they spread out much like the other brothers' descendants do, except Shem's line, like they settle across the Arabian Peninsula, up through the region of the Euphrates and into Syria and stuff like that. And these are the Semitic people, right? So you heard of like Semitism, like that word, Semitic peoples, that comes from Shem, from the name Shem. And it's from these people that Abraham will be called out. It's from these people that God will build around Abraham the family and the nation of Israel. And so these are specifically, or actually a very small group of the descendants of Shem will be the nation of Israel. So that the map looks like this. Noah's descendants, they spread out and they are filling the earth. And as you look at that map, that really is, if you're viewing this from the perspective of Israel in the center, what this looks like is the nations have filled the earth. The inhabitable known earth, it's happening. It's being filled. And they're multiplying. And yet, of course, it's hardly happening in positive circumstances. The thing that's happened just before this filling of the earth is this horrible incident with Noah and his son. The thing that will happen after this is the Tower of Babel, which itself will spread humanity out. So that next week we'll see that one of the reasons humanity fills the earth is because humanity tries to usurp God. And so God scatters them to the ends of the earth. Now, in all of this, I guess I've got three reflections. The first is this. All of this is headed towards Abraham. Like, so in the way that we're meant to read Genesis, we're meant to see that this is directing our eyes, our attention to what God is going to do when he comes to Abraham. Now, Shem and Japheth, the two noble sons of Noah, they do the right thing. Unlike their brother, they do not see their father's nakedness / shame / sin, and they do the right thing. However, as the names and the places flow in chapter 10, and as we see the people scattered after the Tower of Babel, Shem and Japheth's descendants will all be in, like mixed in with the immorality of Ham's descendants. They aren't inherently better than the children of Ham. In fact, between this point and Abraham, there's really not much to write home about for all three lines. And when God does call out Abraham, you're meant to see that this is unusual. You're meant to see that through this one man, as opposed to every other man, every other family, every other people group, through this one man and only through him, God will bring hope to humanity. And so it's still a fairly bleak picture being painted despite Shem and Japheth's nobility. And so if you look at the genealogy again, you know, there's a lot of names there, but do you see this name there? Can anyone read that name? you probably won't even know his name. His name's Peleg, this guy. Peleg. But that guy there, that's Abraham's ancestor. And here in chapter 10, the writer doesn't follow his line. He just tells you about Peleg, and Peleg had a brother, and then he follows his brother's line. And it's as if to say in this chapter, in chapter 10, this family tree, the chapter 10 family tree, it's not a family tree of hope. It will only be a family tree of hope when God grabs hold of this guy's great-great-great-grandson of this bloke's line, and only then will these humans have something to hope for. And in chapter 11, then the writer will follow Peleg's line. And actually, even though we don't follow Peleg's line here in chapter 10, the writer makes this comment. Two sons were born to Eber. Eber's Peleg's dad. One was named Peleg because in his time the earth was divided. Now, in these chapters, there's going to be heaps of family division, heaps of earthly division. There's going to be lots of geographical and political division. There's going to be humanity. In the next chapter, humanity itself is going to be divided into cultures and people groups and languages. But that's not the only division that's going to happen. If you zoom out a bit, actually, God is going to separate out this one line. It's from Peleg, the guy whose name means something like division. It's from Peleg he's going to divide out a single line and separate out a single family. And all of the rest of the book of Genesis, all of it, is about Peleg and his descendants, the line of Abraham. In fact, all of the rest of the Bible is about those to whom the promises of God would come, who are called to be his people, saved by his intervention from the sin that had corrupted the whole lot. All of the rest of the Bible is about the hope that the children of Peleg have, because God sifts out for himself, divides out for himself a people from this moment on. Peleg will be the ancestor of Abraham, the ancestor of Jesus, and it will be Jesus who will save the world. It'll be Jesus who brings the hope that Genesis so clearly shows we need. Jesus is the one who will remove the curse, who will bring the eternal blessing. And you know, he will even save, like his power over sin is so effective, he will be able to save the abhorrent, the sinister, the evil. He will even be able to save those who look more like Ham than Shem. See, often I think we read this story of Noah and his sons, and there's, as I'm going to point out later on, like there is a moral element to this story, and for Israel as they read this, like they should choose to be more like Shem and Japheth than Ham. And so we inherently go, oh well, I need to associate myself with Shem and with Japheth. But actually, what so much of the Bible is saying is exactly what Kirsty just said, that actually our sin is disgusting. Our sin is sinister. And that's because we're like Ham that we need Jesus. The second thing is that this is significant for Israel. Now, hopefully this is clear, what I'm going to describe to you. The whole Ham as the father of Canaan thing, that's really important. The original readers of this book, they were Israel, and you're probably meant to be picturing them sort of sitting gathered, waiting to cross the Jordan to go into the land of Canaan. It's probably how you're meant to be thinking how they're reading about this whole section of the Bible. Now, the earlier generation of that ancient Israel, they were brought out of Egypt at the Exodus, of course, saved, and God makes a covenant with them at Mount Sinai, and then he takes them to the edge of Canaan, and he says, that land over there, that's yours. I'm giving this to you as your inheritance. But then the people do some scouting of that land, and they decide God's wrong. God doesn't know what he's talking about. The Canaanites are too strong. And as a result, that generation of Israel don't enter into the land. Now, keep in mind, the Canaanites, they were genuinely bad news. A really messed up, sordid, gross, evil people. Their idolatry was mixed up with their immorality, and their immorality was like just part of their identity. And so that's what this thing about Ham is showing us. It's showing Israel that Canaan's identity was this, was like Ham's. What's your identity, Israel? You know? Now, that that Ham saw his father's nakedness bit. In Leviticus, the section where seeing nakedness is innuendo for sex itself, that comes within this larger bit. You can go and read Leviticus 18. I mean, that's not that fun to read, so maybe you don't want to read it, but this larger section of Leviticus 18 to 20, and there's all these, so there's all these laws, and they are mostly about sex, laws about sex. The bigger context in that section of Leviticus is that Israel should act like this, live like this in this certain moral way, so that they are not like the Canaanites. And there's this, again, there's this emphasis of not being like the Canaanites, not doing the detestable things the Canaanites do. So that then how does Israel read this? Well, they should firstly be seeing this moral element to how they should live. An example through story about their ancestors, about right and wrong, about choosing right over wrong, about shame and honour. And that to sin and to bring shame, that is not who they were made to be. Because that's like Ham. That's like the Canaanites, those detestable Canaanites that everyone knows are like fully wicked, evil. And rightness and honour that's written into their laws, that's not just like an arbitrary thing that God decides to get them to do. Like it's who they've been made into as God's people. God had planned for them to act with honour even back when their ancestor Shem acted with honour. And so there's this moral element to this story for Israel. And it helps them then understand the purpose of their laws in Leviticus. And so they're given great encouragement to live right and to flee immorality. But there's also this other element, and like this big theological element going on in this. So if you've got this moral element to the story in chapter 9, the way chapter 9 then flows into chapter 10, it's got this theological idea where it's so clear for Israel to be able to say, our God is in control of the world. Israel, they no doubt, as they're surrounded by all these enemies and big ones as well, that they feel small. Many of these great nations will be hostile to them. But in this part of Genesis and over the coming chapters, the beginnings of those great nations are seen here. Like so the nation of Egypt is just sort of shorthanded as just one of Ham's sons. Right? So big nations, and part of what the genealogy is doing is that it's showing Israel that these nations that are big and powerful and that will be hostile towards them, they are subservient to Yahweh. They fit under the sovereignty of Israel's God. And so as much as those foreign kings might attack them, you know who their king is? It's Yahweh. Whether they follow him or not, he's in charge. God is obviously king over them all. And when he does this, when he selects out Abraham and makes Israel his, and when he chooses to bless them, they need to see the grace that Yahweh has shown them in doing that. And that must make them thankful that they belong to him and no one else does. And like those elements, like the moral element of right and wrong and the theological element of Yahweh being in control of all things, those are two vital aspects to what just life is like for the people of God. And you know, both those elements, the moral one and the theological one, they really do get summed up in that old familiar phrase we've seen so many times in the book of Genesis, that God is God and we are not. It's true for Israel, it's true for us. It's this daily thing for God's people to be choosing rightness, to be choosing what is good as determined by God because we belong to him. It is also this daily thing to be living as though God is really in control because God is God and we are not. And it impacts everything from your sexual morality right through to how you view geopolitics. which relates to the third and final thing. All of this is God in control. Now, look at what's happening across these chapters. Humanity is filling the earth. Now, filling the earth, that was part of the blessing that God gave to humanity when God first made them. Genesis 1, God blessed them and he said, fill the earth. This I'm giving this to you. And again, that's pre-fall, and it's what they were made to do, and it's a good thing that they were made to do. And so despite the sin that humanity is just consumed with, and you know, rest assured, everyone in chapter 10, everyone on that family tree is no different to Adam. The state of humanity has never stopped God bringing about what he had always planned to bring about. And as we get to the account of Adam, and then the account of Noah, and then the account of his sons, and then further through Genesis, the writer is showing us that as these generations roll out, sin doesn't stop, but nor do the plans of God. Sin has not sort of trumped what God was doing. All of this is God in control. Now, that's really interesting, I think, because this is a passage that that basically almost has no reference to God at all. I don't know if you noticed that. The one exception is when Noah curses his son. And actually, this whole genealogy is not really much mention of the Lord, of God. Now, when that happens in passages in the Bible, very often, that's the writer showing you that God is doing something behind the scenes. Very often, when God is not referred to in the passage itself, the writer is subtly showing you that it might be oblivious to everyone in the story, but God is absolutely in control. And so despite the situation, God remains in control. And at the end of Genesis, I think you get just the best example of this. At the end of Genesis, we're privy to this conversation between Joseph and his brothers. And if you don't know the story of Joseph and his brothers, what happens is Joseph, he's one of the descendants of Shem, and he's the great-grandson of Abraham. Joseph's brothers almost kill him. Right at the last minute, they decide, let's not kill him, let's sell him as a slave. And so they do. Joseph goes through all this stuff, and he ends up becoming the guy who runs Egypt, of all places, and saves the whole region, the whole Near East, from famine. Now, after all of that, right at the end of the book of Genesis, when these brothers are all old men, Joseph and his brothers, they meet again. And the brothers are sure that this powerful brother of theirs, Joseph, who they hated and tried to kill, they are sure that he's going to kill them. But Joseph says, you intended to harm me. You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. So then, don't be afraid. I will provide for you and your children. Now, that there, that's Joseph reflecting on his life, right? How his life has gone and the intent of his brothers versus the intent of God. And the intent of God wins despite the evil intent of his brothers. However, as the writer records that right at the end of Genesis, I think it's not just Joseph reflecting back. I think the writer of Genesis is actually using Joseph to actually reflect on all that's happened in Genesis. That what Joseph says about his life is what the writer is saying about all of what's happened through human history. So that you've got evil intent after evil intent in Genesis. But God uses all of the events to accomplish what he desires to accomplish. And as we read through Genesis, we're seeing that just like in real time. As we step into Genesis 9, we're seeing evil intent. We're going to see it next week. We're going to see evil intent. I'm going to see it just right through Abraham and Isaac and Jacob's lives. And yet, just God's pacing doesn't miss a beat. Not once. Every time a son sins against a father, every time a father fails to love his son, every time a husband shames his wife, every time a wife dishonors her husband, Every lie, every murder, every theft, every rape, every drunkenness, every time you read of these apparent heroes, you realize that these are not heroes at all. It's not them that overcome. It's not them who defeat their enemies. Because, like you see this, this is proof that they can't be the heroes. Because the hero of this story needs to be able to work over generations, like across centuries. And he needs to be so morally upright that he can remain in absolute purity and be so powerful that he can remain in that absolute purity despite the evil intents of the humanity that he's dealing with. Now, the writer, he might be sort of parodying, like making a parody of the hero story, but he's also making it really clear that Yahweh is the hero of the story, that God is the one who accomplishes his plans. And we, in these chapters, we read of God working in real time to save his people. We see it all the way through the Bible. What we're watching as we read through the Bible is God in real time bringing about his plans. But, you know, we are also living through that theological concept in real time. We live in the world of the sons of Noah. We live in a world, no doubt, and amongst a humanity that has, as we'll see next week, has decided that God is at best replaceable or optional. At worst, he is evil and immoral. We live in the days of Ham, who chooses evil and boasts about it. It's a pretty good summary, I think, of the time we live in. We live in an era that's no different from the era of the Canaanites. And though our idolatry looks different, it's not actually different. And we need to realize that our world is not better. Humanity isn't better than we were. In the West, we love to think that we've progressed from the days of old. We have not. We've just painted our sin a different color. We've just patched up things with Band-Aids and called it progress. Nor, though, are we worse. It's fruitless and, I think, short-sighted to go around decrying the drop in values and morals and the degradation of society. I think that's short-sighted. The Bible is showing us human society has always been a society of degenerates. And realizing that we are neither worse nor better than the days of Noah, we also see that, like the era of Noah, our era is the era of God in control. That is the absolute through all the eras. And as you look around, and even as you experience it and feel it for yourself, every time a child sins against a father fails to love his child, a husband shames his wife, a wife dishonors a husband, every sinister intent, every evil action, every time humanity lets you down, and every time you let humanity down, do you really think God stops being God? Stops being in control? Stops being good? I mean, the cross is the proof of this, right? I mean, this is the epitome of evil intent of humanity and yet good, incredible intent of God. The cross proves that the pain you feel in this life, and even the pain you cause in this life, it does not defeat the goodness of God. The cross is God in control. And we don't see it, we don't see every way that he does it, and we still experience the pain and the tragedy of humanity, but God never stops being God. He never stops being in control. He never stops being good. See that? So this is God in control. And this is God in control, and this is God in control. Which means that this, us, you, me, my life, your life, our life, this is God in control. Because who has held the oceans in his hands? Who has numbered every grain of sand? Kings and nations tremble at his voice. All creation rises to rejoice. Behold our God seated on his throne. Behold our King. Nothing can compare. We're going to sing. going to sing that song, actually. Let's do that now.